Actually, many ways that can be done, and many interesting ways. And if you're building real devices, then that might be of considerable use. But for the moment, we're just going to focus on one case, which is the 1D Schrodinger equation, and then I'm going to restrain myself a little bit further. What I want to look for is basically bound states in some kind of well. Now, you know all about scattering states and so forth, so clearly as we go up above this potential well, then there will be scattering states or free unbound states which will still sort of feel the potential, and you can treat these with similar methods, but you have to be more careful. So for the moment, we'll leave this aside. So what we're looking at is fairly simple, and numerically you could say that we're looking at an eigenvalue problem. So let's see if we can sort this out. So to introduce some way of talking about this, let's assume that I have some well that maybe does something like this. Okay? You can, for most of what I'll be telling you about, assume that it's a square well, but here we don't really, it doesn't really matter. So the equation that I want to solve here is just the usual h bar over 2m, and then del squared xi here, and then plus some potential times xi, and we desire here that this is going to give us just the function back, and then multiply it by a constant e. And so if I rewrite this a little bit, then let's call these regions 1, 2, and 3. And then let's assume here that I have an energy here, which is E, okay? And then I'm going to rewrite the equation that I have for my 1D problem. So I'm gonna assume that I can write it as d or the second derivative here of xi, and that's going to be equal to some 2m over h squared, and then I have a v minus e here psi. Okay. So if we assume that the potential here goes something like this, so maybe I can put in a value, and maybe this here is 0. Okay. In what is the solution to this equation if I'm in region 1 and 3 here? So tell me, if I'm out here, what solution do I have? If the energy is sitting, if the energy is here, that's half the answer. So if we look at it here, so let's just think about, so what I'm talking about is what would the wave function look here and there? And so I assume basically that the potential here is constant, and E is another constant, and then this here is actually going to be bigger than zero, right? So the wave function, so actually what we can write this here as some lambda squared here, psi, where lambda squared, of course, is bigger than zero. So you said that there would be a solution, and what you said, this would be an exponential solution. Is that the whole truth and nothing but the truth? What? Why does it have to do that? Why don't you want it to blow up? But I just talked about this differential equation, right? And the differential equation has two solutions, because we talked about that when we looked at the Bessel functions and so forth, right? So you are entirely right, of course, that when we look at it, then I have one solution, which would be e to the minus lambda x, but I have another one, which is e to the plus lambda x. And it's just because you happen to see that I preceded this differential equation with the name Schrödinger, and then you mentally throw out the unnormalizable wave function. So that's all good, and we know that we probably want to have a wave function that is normalizable, but we're going to have to tell the computer that it shouldn't go looking for this solution, right? So keep this in mind. It's very analogous to what you did when we looked at the Bessel functions, that we're going to be iterating something, but we have to be aware of that there will be other solutions that we somehow have to avoid here. So let's just keep in mind that we have to get rid of this one. Are there any boundary conditions? Yeah. Ah, very good. Very good. So we'll yes. Okay. So it's Remembrance Day today, and we take 1 minute silence now. I think those a minute. So you're right. How this will show up, we'll talk about that in great detail in 2 minutes when I tell you how we're actually going to try to solve this equation. But are there any kind of boundary conditions that we may... So I would call this a boundary value problem. Why would I do that? Are there anything else we want to say about the solution that we're looking for? Yes, I certainly want it to be continuous, but well, imagine here that the roughly there is the additional constraint here that when I look at x and I send it to plus and minus infinity, then I would like the solution to be zero out there. If you like, you can think about this as a condition of the function to be square integrable or whatnot. And it's of course related to the fact that we want this solution and not the other one here. Okay, so. What I'm going to tell you now is how we're going to try to solve this. And so one method of doing that is out of several here is what's called Numerov's algorithm. And it's very good here if there's no first order derivative in the equation. And you can see here that that's precisely the case for the Schrödinger equation. You can use a variety of other methods, but this one actually gives you slightly more precision for the money than other methods in this particular case. So let me tell you how it works here. So I'm going to now assume that I can write the equation that I'm looking for here, and let's call it 1. So the equation that I want to solve here is, the second derivative here of this one, and then plus 2m over h bar. I'm gonna put it here, and then e minus v psi. I'm gonna call that equal to 0, and I'm gonna write this so that whatever is here, I'm going to call it k squared of x. Whatever k squared is defined by e minus v. Okay. So then the other thing we want to do here is that we want to go back and look at what we learned when we talked about differentiation. So if I look at x plus h here, the solution that we want, then I can do a Taylor expansion like we did on several occasions here. So I have something like this, and then H3 over 3 factorial psi 3, and so forth. Okay. And then you can probably guess the game that we're going to play, because I'm now going to take a step in the other direction. And then I get a minus here, H3 over 3 factorial psi 3. Okay, and actually, I think I probably also need the H4 over 4 factorial psi 4. And plus H4 over 4 factorial psi 4. Okay, we're gonna do as we did before. I'm gonna combine these so I can separate out the second derivative here. So if I do this, then psi 2 here. Well, I would have to be adding these two here, so I get psi of x plus h plus psi of x minus h here, and then minus 2 psi of h, and then I need to divide that by h squared. So that was our standard formula, three-point formula for the second derivative of a function. But if we then look at what we get after that, then you can see that I would be, if I'm adding up, I also get twice this term here. So and then I divide it through with h squared. So actually, I get h squared over 12, and then the fourth derivative. And then the next term here, the fifth order, would cancel, but then I would get a sixth order term, and then divide it through with h squared. So there's actually an error here, which is h4. Okay, I'm going to call this equation 2 here. Okay, so the trick that we're going to do, so maybe let's write it over here. So the little trick that Numerov came up with is that we're trying to solve equation 1, but I can get an equivalent equation by applying an operator to equation 1, and that operator is going to do something magical for us. So I'm just going to apply 1 plus h squared over 12, and then ddx squared to 1. Okay. So if I do that, well, I get my I get my psi 2 here, and then I get a plus 8 squared over 12 psi 4, and then I need to apply it to the second term as well, so that gives me k squared times psi here, and then plus 8 squared over 12 of, and then d squared dx squared of k squared psi. Okay. Did I do that right? And this here has to be equal to 0. Okay. So I'm saying that the solution psi that I'm looking for, if it satisfy this equation, then it'll also satisfy this one. And then you can see something magical, because of course I chose this 8 squared over 12 very cleverly, because when I now stick in my value for, so here we want to insert the expression 2 here that I had for the second derivative, and then this term here will cancel with the error term, and I'll get an equation that's supposed to be 0, but to fourth order in H. So if I do this, then I get xi 2 here, which is xi of x plus h plus xi of x minus h here, and then minus 2 over xi, and then over h squared. And then, well, there'll now be an OH4 term, and then I just repeat what I have here. So I get a k squared psi, and then plus 8 squared over 12 times this here of k squared over psi, and that is equal to 0. Okay. So this is formally exact. Once I go in and then put in some numerical approximation for the second derivative, then this here is going to be an approximate equation, and the error here is H4. Okay. And you can see that the only reason why I can play this little game is because I don't really have a first order derivative in the underlying function. Okay, so the other thing is I'm now gonna approximate the remaining term. So I'm just gonna approximate this one using the standard expression, basically this one for the second derivative, right? So I'm going to write that the second derivative here of chi squared over k squared times xi, that's just going to be k squared here in x plus h, xi in x plus h, then plus k squared in x minus h, xi in x minus h, and then minus 2 k squared of x, psi of x. And then I need to divide that by h squared. And then we remind ourselves that the error in doing that is going to be some h squared, which is basically this one. Okay. So this equation here, I'm going to call that 3. And what I have here, I'm going to insert that in 3. And then you get some magical. So I'm going to insert it in 3. And then I'm going to multiply with h squared. And then we can see if we can do this. So I think I can probably erase. So what happens if I do this, I'm going to take this expression here, and then I'm going to multiply through with h squared. So I just get xi of x plus h here, plus xi of x minus h, minus 2 xi of x. Okay. And then I'm going to get plus h squared now, k squared and then all this of x here. So that's just these terms, and then this one here, I'm gonna substitute that expression for this. So remembering that we are multiplying through with h squared, which will remove that one, and then things become magical. So if we look at it here, then I get an h squared over 12, and then I just have the k squared of x plus h, psi of x plus h here, and then plus k squared of x minus h, psi of x minus h, and then minus 2 k squared of x, psi of x. Okay. So that was it. And I claim that that equation has to be equal to 0. And then we just have to think a little bit about the error term. So there was one error term here, which was h4. But I multiplied through with h squared. So that goes up to h6. And then I have one error term here, which is h2 here. But then that gets multiplied by h squared as well. And then there's another h squared there. So that means that the error in this one is actually h6. And most other standard methods that you'd be using would not be of that same high order. OK. So the only thing that now remains to be done is that we can isolate psi of x plus h. So that's sort of what we're after. If we do that, you can see it's just I'm just isolating psi of x in the in this x plus h in this equation. And if you do that, then you get that psi of x plus h here, it's equal to 2 times 1 minus 5h squared over 12 k squared of x, psi of x, and then minus 1 plus 8 squared over 12 chi squared, or k squared of x minus h, applied to psi in x minus h. And then I have to divide here by 1 plus 8 squared over 12, and then k squared of x plus h. Okay, and the error in doing this is in sixth order in h there. So that's the final equation. And so what we're going to do now is we're going to try to integrate up the solution and solve this equation. And we're going to use this expression to do that. And you can see that equation is not very transparent. If I hadn't multiplied through with this thing here, maybe you could have seen some structure to it that would have been more logical. But so be it. When you play this game, you're just going to combine terms and do tricks to get this error here up to a very high order. And it doesn't really matter for you, because you're going to put this into the computer, and it doesn't really matter for you if this expression is complicated or not, because that's what computers are good for. Okay. So that was the mathematics, and that's, so to say, the easiest of it, because now we're going to have to try to use that. And that's where the trouble starts. So So as you were saying, which of these solutions here we should be picking out, that depended on what side of zero I was on. So let's start thinking about how we're going to do this. And I think I can probably erase this this here. So, what's the strategy here? Well, I wanna start at some minus, let's call it XS. I can't remember what I call it in the homework handout. So we wanna start somewhere out here. How would you choose this starting point here? And so, okay, you can see, that's what I should say here, that in order to use this, I need values for psi in x and psi in x minus h here. I'm assuming that the function k squared is known, right? So here, at this point, I want to say that the solution is going to be zero for all practical purposes. How do you want to choose this starting point for your integration? Well, if you know here that the wave function is going to be decreasing exponentially, and you know that the factor it'll be decreasing with is the square root of this distance, then you can just sort of choose your own precision and say, well, I want to start at some point where, for practical purposes, at any rate, I can argue that the wave function would be maybe 10 to the minus 7 or 10 to the minus 8 or some small number, right? So how far you should start away will depend on this distance, right? In other words, if I start looking for eigenvalues in the well that gets up to this point, obviously the wave function will be decaying much further into the forbidden regions, and I'm going to have to start further away, right? So this here will, XS here will depend on E, or good one here. If you say that I'm never going to get close to the rim of this potential well, then maybe you can, you don't have to change it during your calculation. But please be aware that at some point, the wave functions will be leaking way out into the forbidden region. Okay, so then the other thing we do here is I now said psi of minus s and then plus h here. I need another point to start off my integration routine with. I'm going to set that equal to a number, and let's call that number epsilon. Okay, so you can think of this as introducing or multiplying the overall wave function with some number. Obviously here I'm just going to put in some number, and for the actual solution this may not be correct, so I'm going to have to come back later and sort of fix this with some overall normalization. And once you have calculated the wave function, you also know how to integrate it up. Yes? Yes. What are you saying?
You're saying that we have to be careful while choosing the point where we start integrating into our well, because in the far away region, you say we have to say that the solution is approximate exponentially. So exponential, so get a solution, and then you can see what's the next step, so that you can start using numerals on the internet. But I'm saying that if you are already in a region where the exact solution is exponential, like if the potential is zero, the exact solution. Like, we don't have to be very far away because it's already real in the exponential solution.
Yes, but the exponential is always non-zero, right? And I just went in and I set that the solution on my wave function to zero, right?
Why do you want it to be zero?
Because I'm gonna. I need two values to start my iteration with, and so I'm going to take one of them as zero, and then I'm left with just one other parameter here. If you chose both of them non-zero, then you would have too many free parameters to fix later on. That's what I'm saying.
No, because if I know that. And then we can use the fact that it's an exponential to extrapolate what will be the next point. And then you get 2 points. And it seems that it's a better solution because we are not enforcing it to be zero, which is never zero. We already giving it freedom. So.
Why don't you try? What you do here at well, so we all agree that I'm going to have to be able to start this integration somewhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever you do there, it's not written in stone. So you can try to make your choice and see if you can get it to work. Yes?
Well, like, we know the analytical solution on the other side, the potential is zero. Can't we just integrate from the potential? Because outside, if the potential is zero, we know that it is an exponential. So we have three solutions that we have to match on the boundary. So can't we just calculate the value of the boundary and solve in the middle?
But suppose you actually wanted to work with a potential which was not just the box, right? So suppose it actually looked what I was trying to say here, that it sort of went up and did something like this, right? Then you wouldn't know, right? So you can always come, so suppose we design a potential where we know the solution already, right? Then you can really get going, right? In my mind, where, so by the way, I should mention that Pang, I think it's around page 102, he has a potential which, by the way, it's not a box, but it has a different shape. And you can solve that analytically, but it's somewhat non-trivial, and indeed that, of course, is non-zero out to infinity. But there's going to be a region where, when I say that the potential here is zero, then you know, I mean it's small. Okay? So, but, you know, always try to do what you think is right. That's what I was going to say here. But what I would do here is that I would set this one to zero, and then I would choose a neighboring one to be non-zero. And in doing that, then I have introduced a constant factor, so to say, that I multiply the entire wave function with. Okay, but I've done something else here. I've done this, but I have also, I could have changed the sign of the wave function. So what I mean by this is very trivial. Here I set the wave function to be something positive, and you should ask yourself your question, why didn't I set it to be something negative? That doesn't make a difference, but I have made some kind of decision about the overall sign of the wave function, which we are free to choose. So let's now assume that I start this way, and so my starting point, maybe this here is minus xs, and then I want to integrate in that direction, and in that direction the wave function that I desire is going to do something like this. Okay. And the wave function that I want to get rid of, or the other solution to the differential equation, we shouldn't call it a wave function, perhaps it'll be decreasing. So that's sort of very analogous to using the Bessel functions in the way that they work, because I'm integrating this up and the solution that I desire grows and the undesirable solution, it decreases. So this here seems to be okay. Then I hit this I hit the potential well, and things will now start to oscillate. And then I get over and I reach the other side of the well, and then I integrate in that direction, and then trouble will start. Because in this direction, the desired solution will be decreasing and the undesired solution will be increasing. So here, I shouldn't do this. No. I shouldn't be integrating in that direction. So then you get clever and you say, okay, well, I could actually instead start out here at plus xs and then integrate in that direction. Okay? So if we integrate this way, then let's call that solution phi l. And then I'm integrating from the right, and I get another solution, and I call that phi r here. Okay, so then we just have to we have to somehow match phi l and phi r. So. And you can probably guess that what we're looking for is doing an integration where we want to certainly match the slopes, right? Okay. So we're going to have to I'm going to have to choose here a matching point. And I'm going to call that XM for practical purposes here. So suppose now that phi L will look something like this. So this here is phi L. And then phi r here, it looks something like this. And then this here is our matching point. So should we say that this here is a solution? Does this look like a good wave function to you? Yeah, it looks like it has a kink in the middle. But then I go over here, and then I remember that I did something odd because I multiplied. When I set the function to something positive here, so maybe we should say that we set phi L here equal to epsilon, and maybe we do the same thing in the other direction. When I set that equal to epsilon on both sides, then, so this here is epsilon, and this here is epsilon, then you can see that I roughly chose a sign convention which was different on either side. So this actually could be a perfectly valid solution if I basically just multiplied phi r with minus one, right? You wouldn't really know. So the fact that we go in and set, you could of course say, well, you know, I should set both of them to something negative, and or one of them to something negative, and the other one to something positive. If you do that, then you can of course now get clever and say that I know something about the parity of the wave function if the potential happened to be symmetric around x equal to zero, and maybe then you could get really clever. But if your potential is close to symmetric but not quite, then none of these arguments would really work. So I'm going to have to sort of fix whatever overall sign convention that I chose here. And one way I propose to do this is in the matching point, I take, for instance, phi L here, and then let me just see. Last year I did this incorrectly, so I replace it by phi L here, and then the value that the phi r has here, and then right. So this here will force the same sign convention because I'm forcing them to have the same sign where they meet. And then the other thing here is that after this one, then, of course, phi L in XM is always equal to phi R in the XM. Okay, so are you okay with this little trick here? I have to do something like that to get rid of this sign convention. if you want to do otherwise, then of course I can do phi I R and replace it by phi R here, and then phi L in XM over phi R in XM. Something like that, right? So, what we're then left with here is another point. When I do something like this, if I do some rescaling like I just did here, then we see something else, and that's the fact that phi L in XM, it better be different from zero. So when you look at a matching point, it's not a great idea to put the matching point way into these forbidden regions, because when I'm coming from either side, then I'm going to have to be integrating in the wrong direction. So you should take XM roughly inside the well. And the other thing here is you want to take the XM so it's not a node. A node of the wave function. Okay, so that if you know something about quantum mechanics, then often you choose it within or close range of the wall of the potential, because you know that the wave function cannot have a node that's precisely on the wall of the potential well. But there are no real strict rules for how you want to do this. If you want to take it around zero and maybe a little bit off zero, then you can do this. For a potential that's symmetric, it's not a brilliant idea to take the matching point to be precisely at zero. Anyway, you can just go ahead and do this scaling, and then the only thing we now need to do is I have to now match the so I have to do the actual matching of the derivatives. In other words, I want to say that the derivative of phi L minus the derivative of phi R here, I want that to be as close as possible to zero. So if we do this, then I can define phi L here of XM plus H minus phi L of XM minus H. So that would be this derivative here. And then I look at phi R of XM plus H, and then minus phi R of XM minus H. And then we divide here by, 2H. But it doesn't really matter if you divide by 2H, right? And then you have several choices. So this here would just be matching the derivatives now. Sometimes you also stick in a factor here where I divide with the wave function in the matching point. This will define a function which I is going to be parameterized in terms of the energy E. So what you would do here is that you would choose a value for the energy. integrate up from left and the right, see how they meet, and that would give you a value for this f of e. If that turns out to be zero, we have actually found an eigenvalue for the problem. Right, so I can make a little drawing here. If this here is xm minus h, this here is xm, and this here is xm plus h, and this here is phi l, and this here is phi r, then you can see at this point the slopes, they don't really match. And that would actually, if I look at my f of e here, then it would be bigger than zero. And the other scenario where they do something like this, if this here is phi r and this here is phi l, then f of e would be less than zero. Okay. So that's basically it here, except for I can tell you what you should do here is that you should plot f of e, or you can also use another function, which is g of e here, which is just the difference of the two derivatives here, and you can read about that in the homework. So what will it look like? Well, I'm saying here that I'm probably going to start in a configuration where maybe f of e here is bigger than zero. So maybe it'll do something like this. And then I get my first eigenvalue, e. What will the wave function, or what will this f of e, as I've defined it here, what will it then do as I increase the energy? Well, it's actually going to do something perhaps a little bit surprising. It'll go to minus infinity, and then it's going to come in and it'll do something like this. Why will it do that? That's because even though I know that the actual, or maybe I was clever enough to choose the matching point so that the actual wave functions don't have a root in the matching point, but as you're increasing the energy, you know that the lowest eigenfunction will not have a node, okay? But the next one up will have one node. So when you're integrating in, you're pulling in nodes from infinity, if you like. So you're modifying the solution, so suddenly a node appear in the wave function that you're trying to approximate on your numerical scheme. And invariably, that will pass through your matching point. So here I can say that here I have zero nodes. Here I can guess that I have one node. And then it'll jump again because the solution that you're looking at, it developed a new node, right? If a function here goes to from minus infinity to plus infinity and you plot it on a graph, then your x-axis here will be probably from minus a million to a plus million. And the only thing you will ever see is the point where the function here jumps. Yes?
So the function really does that because it will
testify. Yes. Well, it's sort of carrying suspenders and a seatbelt because you're sort of correcting for the fact It's you can view this as a way of fixing your overall sign once again, but you already did that. On the other hand, you can also look at it as visually a good way of seeing that there's going to be one eigenvalue in this interval, one here, and then another one there. Right? So you don't have to ask yourself the question in the interval that I specified, then do I get three eigenvalues or not? If you leave this one out for the potential that I stuck in the exercise, the function that I call g of e without this one, it actually is very well behaved, and you can use that one as well. But let me just point something out here. Depending on how you choose xm, so here you cannot modify the function by choosing another xm as a function of e, so you have to keep xm constant, right, when I'm doing this plot. So what you should do here is figure out where do I have likely a root, and then you can find an interval here, and then you can do bisection on f of e and get the eigenvalue actually to fairly high precision. Okay, but there's no real reason that it'll look as nice as I did here. So in some occasions, it actually happens that the root that you want, it's going to sneak over, so it becomes very, very close to the point where f of e here will jump. And you know, it's sort of unavoidable because you built this into the algorithm. It depends on where x of m is chosen, and if it so happens that you're always far away from a node of the wave function, then likely that root is not going to be close to this jump. But as I start varying e here, then that becomes almost impossible to control. So figuring out where the root is compared to the singularity of this function is sometimes tricky. Yes?
Why do we have to keep the xm constant?
Well, yeah. If you plot f of e here as a function of e, so that you just want to get a ballpark estimate of where the roots are, then it wouldn't make sense to change xm during this procedure because you're actually modifying the actual function. It would be like plotting a second order polynomial ax squared plus bx versus x, but then making a function of some other parameter as you do this. So the position of the actual roots should be independent of your matching point, right? But if I plot this same here with xm2, then the function would not be the same. So it would look something like this, maybe. And the singularities would move. Right? The roots stay the same, but the singularities would move. Yes. So let me just tell you, when I calculated the eigenvalues for this potential, just to verify that they weren't totally off the mark, what I do is that I make a plot like this, which is a rough plot, right? Just to get an idea of in what interval would I expect the roots to be. Then I say that there's likely going to be a root in this interval, and then at that point, I'm going to go in and say, oh, if there's a root in this interval, then I should perhaps choose a matching point that would be corresponding to that root. Okay? That's perfectly fine, but then I'm relying on the fact that the function is now slightly different from this plot here. Does that make sense? So you can play around with this matching point as much as you want, and I would choose the matching point corresponding to the eigenvalue that you're currently focusing on. Okay? So that's probably what you did, but if I let xn vary when I do sort of a global plot like this, then it becomes very confusing. So I wouldn't recommend doing that, right? The other thing I want to point out that I can't remember if we put this in the homework handout, but some people get really carried away and they say, oh, wow, I can now solve any 1D potential to my liking. And then they decide to write a program that will just go in and find, maybe the 21st eigenvalue automatically of any potential that you desire. And, I don't know, go ahead and do that. but I warn you that that's tricky business because these F of E's will be moving according to the potential. So the idea of the homework is just to do something much simpler where you visually make a plot like this and say, I have a root here maybe between -8.6 and -8.5. Okay, so just one interval, and then I can run bisection on that interval after this visual inspection to get the eigenvalue, right? Which is much simpler than if you take a big interval like this and then find all the roots in there, tricky. Fine. Okay, are there? Have you looked at the homework assignment? You read it, thought about it. So there's a lot of freedom in how you want to set this up, and I'm sort of telling you one way of doing it, and you can play around with it. What I recommend that you should do is that have a look at it and then try something, and then when your program is not working, for you guys, it's going to be working first time around, but then ask me questions starting maybe tomorrow morning before we do the lecture, because you can get stuck on this for quite some time. Yes.
Choosing the matching point, we only know that phi L and phi R specific points depending on how we want to discretize our interval.
It's going to be, it'll per definition, it'll be one of the discrete points on the x-axis that you've defined by your step size. Because what you're actually going to be doing here is you'll be matching the derivatives. And the only way you can do that is by doing a numerical derivative at that point. So that means that xn here, per definition, it has to be one of these discrete points. Yes. The other thing that I didn't say anything about is the h that we put in. So you don't take it too big. Less than one. Okay, yeah, so I want to tell you about something else. Remind me tomorrow morning, read the homework. It doesn't involve a lot of programming. And the thing is, if you know all about quantum mechanics and you have thought about what it means if I move the matching point and I do something with it, then it actually works fairly well. Roz is going to tell you no. you can get these wave functions out and all the eigenvalues. But I want to tell you about something else here, and that's something that you'll need for the tutorial this afternoon. And well, maybe before that, then there's a question on the homework, and that's the fact that do we have to define this f of v and all that stuff if v of x here is symmetric around zero? And so you can think about that. If the symmetric, if the potential is not symmetric, you have to do the whole song and dance that we're doing here. But in the case where you know something about the potential, that it has a certain parity or is, you know, it's symmetric, then you can actually exploit that. So think about that, and if you don't see what to do, then we can talk about that. But yes.
So we're going to have to normalize the reflection matrix. So is there an easier way than just go write this problem to integrate it and then dividing by that?
No, that's basically what you're going to be doing, right? And so when you integrate it up, then you'll get an overall constant which will be different from 1. And that will amount to then modifying the absolute value of this epsilon that you put in. The reason why I'm saying it is that quite often people set epsilon to be 0.1. And then you're integrating with your little finite difference equation. And then in the middle of the well, then the wave function will actually take on a value which is in the excess of 10 to the 38. Depending on how finely you integrate and how far away you started. So then they plot the wave function, and then all they see is that everything just diverged in the middle. So you have to be, you have to then go back and then decrease the epsilon and so forth. So if you want to look at something that makes sense, then better try to normalize the wave function so they come out and look reasonable. I now want to tell you a little bit about how we can solve Laplace's equation, because there's a cute story to this. So I'm looking at some cavity here, and then I want to solve the equation that for the potential that the Laplacian acting on it is equal to 0. Okay. So for what we want to talk about here, we assume that this here is a cavity, but on the walls of this cavity, we hold the potential fixed to some values. And then what you're interested in is actually solving for the potential inside the cavity. Okay? And this is actually something that is quite useful and is often done. And in some settings, you can solve this using analytical methods. But let me just see how we would do this, because it looks vaguely similar to what we did here, but in the end it'll be something quite different here. So I'm gonna look at now the derivative here in the delta x direction here, and I'll assume that I can just use my usual Taylor expansion. So I have some du dx here, and then delta x, and then plus some 1/2, the second derivative of du dx, and then delta x squared. If I do the same thing here in the delta y direction, then I get the same thing. So I get du dy now and delta y, and then plus 1/2, and then the second derivative, delta y squared. Okay, so I can I can use these and then combine them just as I did before. So when I look at this, then I could also have calculated for x minus delta x, but we already did that twice today. So in the end, I can see here that the second derivative with respect to x squared here is u of x plus delta x, and then y, and then plus u of x minus delta x, and then y, and then minus 2 u of x and y, and then I should divide here over delta x squared, and then the second derivative with respect to y squared, it's u of x y plus delta y plus u of x y minus delta y minus 2 u of x and y over delta y squared. Okay, so if I now, maybe this is an oversimplification, but if I go in and assume that the way I'm discretizing and then the x and y direction are the same, then the Laplacian acting on u here, I can just add these up. So I would this here is just going to be u of x plus delta x here, or plus delta, and then y, and then plus u of x minus delta, and then y, plus u of x and y plus delta, and then plus u of x and y minus delta, and then minus 4 times u x and y. And so here, what I do here is I've multiplied through with, so maybe we should do something like this, multiplied through with delta squared, because that's just going to be a constant. So when I rearrange this equation, then u of x and y here, it's a quarter. And then u of x plus delta, and then y, and then plus u of x minus delta, and y, and then plus u of x and y plus delta, and then plus u of x and y minus delta. So I did something that is slightly different from what we did for the Schrödinger's equation, even though we're discretizing, and so that sort of looks the same, but I came up with this equation. So the way to think about it is that if we look at the grid here, so this would be x and then y plus delta, and this here would be x plus delta and y, then I'm saying here that the solution that I desire to this order, it's actually simply going to be that in the point x and y, I'm going to look at 1/4 of the sum of the neighboring points. So that's sort of on this lattice version of the Laplacian, then that's one way of looking at it. So how do we want to solve it? The idea here that's quite often used is we want to use iteration. And this is actually an idea that also probably goes back to Jacobi, sometimes called Jacobi's method. So I could define, I can look at this and read it as an iterative equation, right? So I can say that u nu here in the point x and y, I can get it as 1/4, and then u old here in x plus delta and y plus u old and u old and u old, right? I could get that idea where I take an entire array here, discretize the points, call that u old, and then I get new version simply by looking at these 4 points here and using that to get this point over here, right? So then you're probably going to say that why would this ever work? And the reason that this works is fairly easy to see. So I can look at the stability of this, so if I assume that uxy of the old grid that I had here, if I assume that that is always less than or equal to alpha, then the new one here, you can see that that is going to be equal or less than or equal to this expression. So I'm going to get 1/4 here, and then I can use the usual inequalities and see that I get 4 alphas here, right? So if there's no absolute value of my potential that exceeds the value of alpha here, then when I iterate here, then the new values can also not exceed alpha. The interesting point in this is perhaps that you can see that 1/4 here, that's precisely the limit of stability So if you play around with it this afternoon, you can go in and then instead of setting it equal to 0.25 here, then you can set it equal to 0.26, and then it'll likely explode in your face. So the problem that we want to solve is the case where I have a value of 100 for the potential here, and then 0 on the walls. And that's actually a potential that can be solved analytically, and I think in the tutorial today, the analytical solution is there as well. And it is? Yeah. You can have a look at it, and of course you should be worried here about the fact that there is a discontinuity. So when you're running your trying to solve it, you do not touch the values that corresponds to the wall of the cavity. In other words, the values here in the first column and the last column and the top row, you keep them to what values they were defined at. And then under successive iterations, you're going to be building up the potential inside the cavity. And this is actually something that's quite useful. In this case, even though the analytical solution is available, then this numerical approach will actually give a solution that is smooth. And you can try to do the sum that you would getting from the analytical solution, and you'll see that it's not particularly well behaved. The interest in this method is that suppose now somebody makes a little dent in this cavity because they're inserting some apparatus, then your nice analytical solution is just it is just vaporized, right? On the other hand, for the numerical solution, it's trivial to make a little dent there because that would just be modifying the way you would be updating the grid, so you can modify your cavity to your own pleasure and look at the solutions in there. I need to tell you two more things here because so that's Laplace. It always works. It's very nice, and it's extensively used here with this Jacobi method. So I just wanted to end today here by telling you something about pointers. Because imagine here that you take a big array like this, and the amount of data in there is a few gigabytes. And I want to iterate with this equation, then if I need to copy what is in U old into temporary storage, then override U old with U new, and then start calling U old for U new, then I'm going to be moving around gigabytes of gigabytes. So what we want to do here is I want to switch between U new and U old here using pointers. And so I have to tell you about how you use pointers in Fortran. So let's see if we can figure this out. So I declare some real here. And then I say that it's going to have a dimension so that it's a two-dimensional array. And I'm going to call that let's be specific here. So let's say that it goes from 0 to L and then 0 to L, and let's call this U new and U old. And then I'm going to be looking for something so that I can point to these things. And the things that I'm using for pointing, I'm going to call that pointer 1, pointer 2, and then TPR for temporary pointer. And so the way that pointers are implemented in Fortran is quite different from other programming languages. It does the same thing, but it's quite a bit more restrictive. So you have to allow an object to be pointed to. The way you do that is that you call it a target. And then when I want something to point with, I'm going to give it an attribute here, which is pointer. And so with this pointer, I can point to something that is a two-dimensional array, but only if that two-dimensional array has been given permission to be pointed to, right? And so how does things work? Well, the first thing you might want to do here is that I want to say the first pointer, I want to have it point to uOld, right? And then the next statement I'm going to do here, well, okay, so what happens at this point, forget about what is actually done, but after this statement, which is sort of the only new thing that you can do with a pointer, that you cannot do with something that doesn't have this pointer attribute, then after this point, all operations on PTR1 are performed on uNew. Oh, sorry, uOld. Okay? So what happens now when I said PTR1 equal to 1? What would you guess would happen then? Yeah? Precisely, right? So after this point, you can literally just read PTR1 as being synonymous with writing uOld. There's no funny stuff, no stars, no nothing. I can go in and say PTR1 of 1, 1 equal to 10. So this year we'll be operating on that one. Okay. So then we say that PTR2 here, I set it to point to uNew. And then I do my iteration, and then I want to interchange these things. So it's very simple to modify a code that you have, so you're using pointers instead of actual data, because you just have to declare whatever you're working on a pointer, and that's it. So if I want to interchange them, then I go in and say the temporary pointer here, I set it to point to pointer 1, right? So what happens here is that this here is pointing to uOld. And then I say that pointer 1 here, I now set it to point to whatever pointer 2 is pointing to. And then I say that pointer 2 here, I set it to point to what temporary pointer 1 is pointing to. Right? So if we had a scenario here where this was pointer 1 and this here was pointer 2, then after, then it'll be the other way around. Pointer 2 is now going to be pointing there, and pointer 1 will be pointing over there. These operations will likely not include more than a single copy of a 32-bit word. Right, so this would be 3 modifications of a 32-bit word versus copying 8 gigabytes around in your memory. So I cannot do, if you're used to in C, then you can do sort of pointer arithmetics where I can modify the value, or I can increase the value that is stored in the pointer by 2 and sort of strange things like this. That's not at all possible in Fortran, because they don't want you to be poking around in memory. This here is the only thing you can really do with a pointer that is new. And so the only thing you can do is that you can set it to point to something, and that's it. You cannot play around with the actual address that's stored in the pointer. Are there questions about how these pointers are used? Yeah. Well, yeah.
Is the syntax like pointing to UO is like equal sign and larger than?
Yes, yes. Which is not obvious. Yeah.
Why do we want to keep 2 copies of our links? Wouldn't the conversions be faster if we used previously computed on the same information?
Well, you have to be a little bit careful. You could get clever and say that if I start here with 100 and then 0000, then you can be clever and say the only thing that can happen in the first iteration is that this row here will become non-zero, right? So, and then in the next iteration, then I could say that this could be non-zero, and then that row would become non-zero. If we could do some graphics, then it's interesting to see how the solution is evolving as a function of the iteration number. It's quite amusing. The end solution looks like saran wrap, right? That you pack your lunch every morning. Maybe you don't do that, but then you wrap it in this plastic. So at this point, you can get clever, and I can say that there's only a need here to be modifying that row. The point is, if you don't work on 2 copies, so tricks like this are possible. I'll give you that. But if you don't work on 2 copies, this stability here thing goes out the window. So I can no longer prove that what I'm doing will forcibly remain stable. So it's at that point at your own risk. But it's possible to come up with schemes where you can convince yourself that you can do the update in a cleverer way.
We completed this point.
Mm-hmm.
Then this next point here, we would compute not saying that this was 0 in the old place, but saying that it's already like the new point.
Yes, it's a question of whether you can then argue that you're going to be iterating to the same fixed point. And any modifications of that style would, of course, be many times faster than this, but the fail-safe iteration to a stable fixed point, that becomes very hard to see. So usually you would be working on 2 copies, because you just don't want to make a slight modification and then suddenly whatever you're doing is it goes out the window. So that's the reason. But yeah, by all means, if you're looking at a particular case where you can convince yourself that you're going to reach a stable fixed point with another clever way of doing the updating, yeah, you can do that. Sorry for taking a bit more time today. But you know, we needed to get this in, because you're going to be using this for the tutorial today.